Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine. Today's program is underwritten by the law firm of W.G. Alexander & Associates. Alexander attorneys provide top-rated and experienced legal counsel concentrating on estate planning, elder law, special needs, and asset protection. Call W.G. Alexander & Associates at 919-256-7000. We're reading this week from the February 4th, 2022 issue of The Week magazine. The cover drawing this week shows President Joe Biden. He's actually underwater. Looks like the ocean or a sea. He's in his typical dark suit, blue tie. He's smiling. He's got two thumbs up. There's a little fish. Looks like Nemo swimming up to look at him. Off to the left, there's a COVID mask floating, and above him, an empty bottle. The headline is Sinking Popularity, Why Biden's Poll Numbers Are Underwater 1 Year Into His Presidency. And we'll pick that up later, but we start with the first main story. U.S. moves troops as Ukraine tensions mount. What happened? The Pentagon put 8,500 American troops on heightened alert for possible deployment to Eastern Europe this week, as the Biden administration warned that Russian military aggression against Ukraine could result in crippling technological and economic penalties and personal sanctions against President Vladimir Putin. Biden reiterated that he has no intention of putting American forces in Ukraine to deter or counter Russian aggression, and said the U.S. troops would be part of a multi-nation NATO response force providing security for its member nations. But he warned that an invasion would trigger enormous consequences worldwide and floated a plan to ban exports to Russia of computer chips made with U.S. tools or designed with U.S. software. NATO member countries, including Spain, Denmark, and Holland, readied forces to move ships and fighter jets into Eastern Europe, though conspicuously absent was Germany, whose new chancellor, Olaf Scholz, has ruled out sending arms to Ukraine. Putin flexed his muscles with a show of elaborate military drills to the north, south, and east of Ukraine, where it has massed some 125,000 troops and dispatched additional Russian forces and weaponry to neighboring Belarus. Putin spokesman Dmitry Peskov blamed the U.S. for ratcheting up tensions in the region, calling Biden's readying of troops a matter of profound concern. U.S. anti-tank missiles and other weapons were delivered to Ukraine, and the State Department ordered family members of diplomats in Kyiv to leave, warning that a Russian invasion could come at any moment. Kristen Kiven, the U.S. top diplomat in Ukraine, warned that any incursion would face fierce resistance from its army and citizens. The losses to Russia will be heavy, she said. What the editorial said. Biden is finally showing the backbone that's needed in dealing with the man who would be czar, said the Chicago Tribune. A buildup of NATO troops on Russia's doorstep is what Putin wants to avoid, but it's exactly what's needed. By threatening Ukraine, the Russian provocateur is hoping to make NATO devolve into disunity, which is why any sign of a break in unity in the alliance would be disastrous. Strength is the only language Putin understands. Let's hope it's not too late, said the Wall Street Journal. There's more the U.S. can do short of sending troops into Ukraine, including delivering anti-tank and anti-aircraft missiles, assisting with air and sea defense, and imposing direct economic sanctions in our arsenal. That includes denying Russian access to the SWIFT financial system that enables large dollar transactions. the U.S. must do whatever we can to raise the cost of invasion. If we fail, the consequences will extend far beyond Ukraine. What the columnist said. Is Putin bluffing? Asked Adam Taylor in the Washington Post. As the Biden administration braces for a major conflict, many European leaders remain skeptical he'll actually invade. Some see the military buildup as a ploy to force concessions from the West, such as a rollback of NATO's eastern expansion and a written agreement that Ukraine will never join NATO. Others say Putin's performative diplomacy is the real bluff. But even if Putin is bluffing, would he make such a big bet and walk away from the table with nothing? Putin has three linked goals, said Walter Russell Mead in the Wall Street Journal. Break NATO, throw the European Union into disarray, and restore as much of the old Soviet empire as possible. So far, he's making meaningful progress, with Germany blocking NATO allies from giving German-made weapons to Ukraine, and France making noises about rethinking the alliance's goals. Not since the 1940s has the West been this disunited. Trying to appease Putin is a fool's errand, said Brett Stevens in the New York Times. His apologists contend that if we make a few concessions, he'll be satisfied. But that logic ignores two factors: Putin's personal political needs and his far-reaching ideological aims. He's a dictator bent on staying in power at all costs and whipping up periodic foreign crises to mobilize domestic support is a standard ploy straight from the dictator's playbook. However this drama is resolved, there will be more Putin-generated crises on the horizon. Appeasing him now emboldens him for later. And we've got a shorter second main story. Documents reveal Trump team plotting. What happened? Donald Trump and his circle faced renewed scrutiny this week over the alleged attempts to overturn the 2020 election. The Justice Department confirmed it was investigating fake certificates containing slates of electors for Trump that were sent from seven swing states won by Joe Biden. Multiple sources have traced the certificates, which were signed by Republican state officials, back to recruitment efforts spearheaded by Trump lawyer and advisor Rudy Giuliani. Legal scholar John Eastman had pressured Vice President Mike Pence in a memo to use certificates to halt the electoral count under the pretext that he could not decide between competing slates of electors. Benny Thompson, the Democrat from Mississippi, chair of the House committee investigating the January 6 insurrection, said that former Attorney General Bill Barr is cooperating informally and that Ivanka Trump was asked to testify. The committee's letter to Trump's daughter and senior advisor cited information gained from former White House aides that she had implored her father multiple times to stop the rioters during the Capitol attack. The January 6 committee this week received 770-plus pages of internal Trump administration documents that the former president had tried to keep secret after the Supreme Court rejected executive privilege claims. The trove includes a draft of an executive order calling for the National Guard to seize voting machines based on false claims of foreign interference. It also would have ordered Defense Secretary Christopher Miller to spend 60 days writing a report on the election, keeping Trump in power until at least mid-February 2021. What the columnist said. The feds are finally taking on the Trump team's almost certainly criminal phony elector gambit, said Philip Rotner in the Bulwark. Some of those implicated claim the documents were merely a backup plan in case Congress or the courts voided the 2020 results. But in the clearest possible language, the infamous Eastman memo identified the alternative elector slates as central to Trump's plot to overturn the election. The legal walls are closing in on Trump, said Kimberly Well in The Hill. The Supreme Court's 8-1 decision on executive privilege bypassed the thorny question of whether a former president's claim can withstand a sitting president's waiver, ruling that Trump's claims would have failed even if he were the incumbent. His lawyers may try to assert privilege in future cases to thwart probes by the Justice Department or Georgia's Fulton County, but we now know that they will almost certainly lose. Yet the Justice Department shows little sign of pursuing Trump himself, said Max Boot in the Washington Post, and it would be difficult to build a case against him. The former president can claim that his "fight like hell" exhortation to supporters was just typical political hyperbole, and that telling Georgia Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger to find more votes stemmed not from seditious intent, but from the genuine, if delusional, belief that fraud truly had occurred. The wheels of justice alone cannot stop his political career, which is why he remains a free man and the front runner for the 2024 Republican presidential nomination. Controversy of the week is the pandemic. What would endemic COVID mean? After 2 long years of contagion and death, there are finally solid reasons to hope that the pandemic's grip is loosening, said Naomi Kresge in Bloomberg. The wildfire spread of the Omicron variant, less malevolent in causing fatal illness, is conferring a new layer of natural immunity on tens of millions of Americans and billions of people worldwide, on top of that already achieved by vaccines, booster shots, and previous bouts of infection. Scientists, meanwhile, are rolling out effective new antiviral therapies and testing variant-specific boosters. Taken together, these developments have sparked hope we're entering COVID's endemic phase. That means COVID would continue to circulate and flare seasonally, but would become a largely manageable disease that can finally move to the back burner of public discourse. That moment is upon us, said Dan Hannon in Washington Examiner. All the restrictions we've endured, including business and school closures and vaccine and face mask mandates, make no sense when applied to an endemic disease. If we don't drop those restrictions now and reclaim our freedoms, I fear we never will. Endemic doesn't mean what you think it means, said Catherine Pearson in HuffPost. The term simply denotes the point at which an infectious disease has largely stable case numbers. With new Omicron infections soaring to 800,000 a day, hospitals in some states struggling with an avalanche of patients, and more than 15,000 dying every week, we aren't close to that yet with SARS-CoV-2. Even if we do reach a predictable, non-disruptive point of living with COVID, a new variant could emerge at any moment that evades acquired immunity and puts us back to square one. There is a widespread, rosy misconception that viruses evolve over time to become more benign, said evolutionary virologist Aris Katsirakis in Nature. This is not the case. The next variant of COVID may well be more deadly, more transmissible, and or more vaccine resistant than Omicron. If we drop all precautions now and let the virus continue to spread and mutate, it sets humanity up for many more years of disease, including unpredictable waves of outbreaks. Caveats abound, said Helen Branswell in statnews.com. But most experts do think that when the Omicron wave subsides, it will have left the immunological landscape in the U.S. and the world profoundly altered. This variant is so infectious that some epidemiologists predict half or more of the population will get it. Vaccinated people who get breakthrough Omicron infections could develop very broad immune defenses against coronaviruses. All that immunity should slow things down, at least for a while. Perhaps, said Greg Ipp in the Wall Street Journal, but anyone dreaming that the world will return to normal after Omicron needs a reality check. Even in the best-case endemic scenario, we'll still be living with a disease that kills more than 100,000 vulnerable people a year, roughly three times the average for the flu. The coming reprieve is a chance to tighten our defenses, not relax them, said Dr. Ashish Jha in the Washington Post. We need to ramp up vaccinations and fund a Warp Speed 2.0 to search for a pan-coronavirus vaccine that might protect against all future variants. No, the pandemic isn't over, but we have reason to hope that the worst is behind us. We will have tools to handle what comes next, no matter what Mother Nature sends our way. Here's our good week, bad week piece. It was a good week for the pursuit of liberty after a Roomba robot vacuum cleaner escaped from a hotel in England and spent a full day at large in the outdoors before being located under a hedge. The device, hotel officials said, is now back with the rest of its robot vacuum family. It was a good week for surface tension after French physicists invented a super durable bubble of water and glycerol that held its shape for a staggering 465 days, defying cliches about bubbles being fragile and ephemeral. And it was a good week for the dictator's cut, with reports that China's streaming service has altered the cult classic Fight Club to have a happy, pro-authoritarian ending. In the original 1999 film, a bomb destroys a city skyline, but in China's version, that scene is replaced by the words, "The police rapidly figured out the whole plan and arrested all criminals." It was a bad week for distinctions after Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell told reporters that if you look at the statistics, African-American voters are voting in just as high a percentage as Americans. It was a bad week for shopping, with the arrest of a Texas woman who allegedly tried to buy the cute child of a woman next to her in the self-checkout line at Walmart. When her first offer of $250,000 was rebuffed, police said, Rebecca Taylor, 49, doubled the price to $500,000 as the shaken mother grabbed her kid and fled. Finally, it was a bad week for Tucker Carlson, who complained that the maker of M&M's removed the stiletto heels of M&M characters in TV ads. The characters are now totally androgynous, Carlson said, and you wouldn't want to have a drink with any one of them. The briefing this week is titled, The Prison Beyond the Law. The U.S. has been holding terrorism suspects at Guantanamo Bay for 20 years. Will the camp ever close? Why was Guantanamo created? The military detention facility, first called Camp X-Ray, was built in 3 days in early January 2002. To receive al-Qaeda and Taliban prisoners captured during the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan. Shortly after January 11th, when the first 20 detainees arrived, the Pentagon released a startling photo of the men in orange jumpsuits, hooded and shackled, kneeling on the ground by a barbed wire fence. The image sparked a national debate over human rights and national security that continues to this day. Over the next 20 years, the U.S. spent $11 billion on the camp as it expanded into a large compound called Camp Delta. Some 780 Muslim men and boys from Pakistan, Afghanistan, Saudi Arabia, and other countries cycled through its prison cells, almost all without charges or trials. In the first 3 years, many were subjected to enhanced interrogation techniques, such as waterboarding, beatings, and being forced to stay awake or exposed to blaring music for days. Only two were ever convicted of war crimes. After years of gradual releases and reparations under four presidents, 39 remain in custody. What is their legal status? It's in limbo. While trying to extract information from the prisoners, the Bush administration didn't want them to be subject to the Geneva Conventions, so it classified them as illegal enemy combatants, a term not defined in international law. Trying these suspected terrorists in court, the administration said, was too big a risk. Those acquitted for lack of evidence could go free on U.S. soil and plot new attacks on Americans. So it sent the prisoners to the U.S. military base in Cuba, beyond the jurisdiction of U.S. courts. But a series of Supreme Court cases determined that the detainees could challenge their detention in federal court, and most obtained lawyers. Who has been detained there? At the outset, then Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld said the camp was housing only highly trained, hardened terrorists, the worst of the worst. A few detainees were, in fact, top al-Qaeda members, such as the suspected 9/11 mastermind, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. But many were low-level Taliban or jihadist fighters with no involvement in terrorist plots against the U.S., and dozens of others were later found to be innocent people swept up by Afghan or Pakistani forces chasing the U.S. bounty of $5,000 per capture. Hundreds of inmates were later transferred to other countries, but some were held for years. Seven have died by suicide, and dozens of others have attempted it. Why hasn't the prison closed? When President Obama took office in 2009, he ended the use of torture and ordered that the Guantanamo Bay camp be closed within a year, with prisoners deemed dangerous, given trials, and sent to U.S. maximum security prisons. But with both Republicans and Democrats insisting, rather improbably, that terrorists which might escape the supermaxes, which houses mass murders and other terrorists, Congress passed a law barring the transfer of detainees to U.S. territory. In 2018, President Trump reversed Obama's closure order, and detainees who were slated for release had their transfers delayed. Of the 39 prisoners who remain, 10 are awaiting trial, 2 were convicted, and the other 27 were never charged. The trials have moved at an agonizingly slow pace. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and 4 co-defendants in the 9/11 attack have been in pretrial hearings for years, with their lawyers arguing that the evidence against them is inadmissible because it was obtained by torture. Will Biden close it? The Biden administration says it is committed to closing the facility as soon as possible, but it has yet to appoint an official to oversee the process. Meanwhile, Republicans in Congress oppose efforts to release the uncharged prisoners, citing a 2020 declassified intelligence report that said 229 of the more than 700 detainees who have been released have returned to terrorist activities. At a Senate hearing, Senator Lindsey Graham said at least 5 people in Afghanistan's current Taliban government are former Guantanamo detainees. "And we're talking about releasing people," he said. "This is nuts." So is Guantanamo necessary? In a 2010 memoir, former President George W. Bush conceded that Guantanamo Bay had become a propaganda tool for our enemies and a distraction for our allies. Since then, Islamic extremist groups, including al-Qaeda and ISIS, have continued to invoke the torture and unlawful detention of Muslims there in their recruiting, while a new UN report called the site a stain on the U.S. commitment to the rule of law. retired Marine Corps Major General Michael Leonard, who was in charge of setting up the camp, recently told a Senate hearing that it was a mistake for the U.S. to create an extra-legal offshore prison. The urgency to gain information had bad consequences, Leonard said. When you forego generations of legal thought and precedent, bad things happen. Moving into the best columns of the week, we'll start with two from the U.S. Last chance for climate legislation. If the U.S. is going to act on the climate in the foreseeable future, said David Linhart, it will almost certainly need to be through a Democratic bill signed by a Democratic president. It's quite possible Democrats will lose control of the House and perhaps the Senate next year, which makes it urgent that they pluck the climate change portion from the blocked Build Back Better bill and pass it as standalone legislation. The climate provisions, costing about $555 billion over 10 years, would heavily subsidize wind, solar, and nuclear power and provide a $7,500 rebate for buying an electric car. These incentives would make it cheaper for businesses and homeowners to transition to clean energy, accelerate that change, and enable the U.S. to reach its 2030 targets for reducing greenhouse gas emissions. And surprisingly, it may be politically possible. Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia, who blocked BBB, said he and his Democratic colleagues probably can come to an agreement much easier on the climate provisions than on other components of BBB. Republicans still oppose any action on climate change, so if Congress doesn't pass a bill to slow carbon emissions over the next few months, it may not do so for years. Jenny Thomas, far-right activism. In a speech last fall, said Jane Meyer, Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas accused the media of portraying the justices as partisans who indulge their personal preference. But Thomas' dubious claim of neutrality is being severely undermined by the far-right activism of his wife, Jenny Thomas. Owner of a political consulting firm that generates substantial income for the couple, Jenny Thomas insists that America faces an existential threat from the deep state and the fascist left, and she adamantly opposes abortion, gay marriage, and affirmative action, and aggressively promotes gun rights. On January 6, she promoted former President Trump's Stop the Steal rally, writing, Love MAGA people. She personally lobbied Trump on political issues and hirings and has denounced the House January 6 committee as an unjustified political prosecution. Last week, only one justice voted in favor of Trump's attempt to withhold his White House documents from that committee, Clarence Thomas. He has declined to recuse himself from cases in which his wife's activism creates an apparent conflict of interest, even when groups that Jenny Thomas belongs to have filed friend of the court briefs on cases he's deciding. His claims of neutrality ring hollow. This column comes from the UK. Ghost fishing is trashing our oceans. The fishing industry is treating the ocean like a giant garbage dump, said George Monbiot. In recent years, so many nets and long lines have ended up in the waters around the UK that this ghost gear now routinely entangles and drowns dolphins, seals, and seabirds. I've long wondered how fishing vessels manage to lose so much equipment, and now I may have an answer. A trawlerman working in Scotland tells me that large trawlers, many from France and Spain, don't have enough storage space to house the trash they generate, because most of the hold is dedicated to frozen fish. So while at sea, the crews will cut off and save the expensive, reusable parts of their gear, floats, weights, and hooks, and toss their worn-out nets overboard. they get away with this act of vandalism because once you're 12 miles or more out from the British coast, UK law no longer applies. Beyond that point, my contact says, it's basically bandit territory for any vessel not US, not UK registered. British authorities could pass a law requiring all fishing vessels that dock at UK ports to have sufficient space for trash and introduce mandatory deposit return schemes for fishing gear. Yet, faced with total ecological collapse, our leaders seem content to simply sit tight and assess. The last word, our in-depth article, titled this week, Life in Jail for the January Sixers. In the D.C. Central Detention Facility, said journalist Andrew Bujon in Washingtonian Magazine, the Capitol riot defendants sing, pray, watch The Bachelor, and gripe about the jail's barbershop's vaccine mandate. There's a strong chance Jacob Chansley is who you think of when you recall the January 6 riot. Better known as the QAnon Shaman, Chansley strode into the Capitol shirtless on that overcast wintry day, showing off a torso covered in tats. His face was painted with three finely rendered red, white, and blue triangles. The remains of several coyotes swaddled his head, while bison horns jutted from either side of his headdress. He carried a bullhorn in his gloved hands as well as, depending on your perspective, a flagpole with a misaligned, loose-fitting finial atop it, per Chansley's erstwhile defense attorney, Albert Watkins, or a six-foot spear, the government's point of view. Chansley stood in the Senate balcony while other Trump fans rifled through senators' desks. He pounded his pole spear on the floor and chanted wordlessly in a loud baritone. Later, as he waltzed into the chamber downstairs, he switched to English. "Blankin' A, man," he said, by way of introducing himself to fellow insurgents, in video captured by a New Yorker reporter. "Glad to see you guys. You're effing patriots." He installed himself on the dais. "I'm going to take a seat in this effing chair because Mike Pence is a traitor." He asked a fellow rioter to snap his picture. Before leaving, he thanked God for the opportunity to send a message to the tyrants, the communists, and the globalists, and scribbled a note on some papers meant for the vice president. "It's only a matter of time. Justice is coming." Come February, Chansley had apologized for taking part in the riot. By that point, he was among dozens of other January 6 defendants behind bars in the nation's capital. Many were accused of meting out shocking violence on the police, and lots of them had a long history of violent crimes. Chansley met neither criterion, but, as Watkins says, Jake is, for better or for worse, the face of the insurrection. Anyway, at that point, the QAnon shaman had bigger problems than being locked up with a bunch of purportedly violent would-be putschists. The D.C. jail wouldn't serve him organic food. Chansley, see, has a belief in shamanism. And the shamanic diet, well, the exact strictures on the shamanic diet are still a bit fuzzy. Watkins told the court he couldn't find a reliable shaman advisor to explain why wild-caught canned tuna is integral to the spiritual practice, but argued that the shaman's 9-day hunger strike was proof his faith was sincere. If D.C. couldn't deliver food that comported with Chansley's faith, he should be moved to a jail that could. The prosecutor also couldn't find documentation on shamanic culinary traditions, which the Fed said meant Chansley would stay put. This wasn't Judaism or Islam. If the strictures couldn't even be established, how was the jail offending anyone's religion? But as it happened, an Arizona jail that previously had held Chansley had served him pesticide-free fare. That was good enough for Judge Royce Lamberth. Chansley was relocated to an Alexandria, Virginia jail, which, Watkins told me, had done a splendid job in the kitchen for the shaman. A lack of sustainably farmed produce might sound like a rather precious complaint coming from a fur-clad autodidactic who tried to overturn an election in the world's oldest continuous democracy. But Chansley isn't exactly a lone coyote amongst MAGAs in griping about the D.C. jail, which might make you wonder, what exactly did they think it would be like? The D.C. Central Detention Facility is even more segregated than the city it serves. Just 3% of the inmates, on average, are white. 87% are black. What happens inside when you lock up dozens of overwhelmingly white men arrested as part of a radical right insurrection? The jail's overseers decided they didn't want to find out. The Sixers, as they're known to their faithful, were confined to a medium security annex, away from the other prisoners. The brass call the block C2B, or Charlie 2 Bravo. Its 40 or so residents call it Patriots Pod. "We work as a team in here," said Brandon Fellows, a 27-year-old Sixer from Central New York. "We pray together. We sing together." Fellows is the guy who climbed through a broken Capitol window and admitted to taking a hit off a doobie in Senator Jeff Merkley's office. He got to the pod in August. "Right around Thanksgiving, I began trading calls with him and another inmate, Nathan DeGrave, to hear how life on the wing was doing. It's more so a democracy than, say, you know, a monarch," says DeGrave, a 32-year-old Las Vegas resident accused of encouraging people to take everything after he forced his way into the Senate chamber. Both Fellows and DeGrave have pleaded not guilty. "We kind of all listen to each other and get input from each other, so I would have to say there's no specific or definite leaders in this pod." There may be no king mackerel in the fishbowl, but facets of life inside sound eerily similar to the alternate universe that ultra-right-wingers occupy on the outside. Most of the Sixers' existence goes down in isolation. The cells on Charlie 2 Bravo are singles. Each day they get a 5.5-hour window of rec, or time outside the cell. One day it's from 9 a.m. to 2:30 p.m. Then they wait 25.5 hours for the next day's rec, starting at 4. Sixers on that rotation get to take part in a cherished ritual, singing the national anthem in unison at 9 p.m. When they get to the lyric that our flag was, they shout the last two words, "Still there." Basketball is big. They play on an indoor court now that winter's here, as is venting about being political prisoners in a totally un-American American gulag, their words. They discuss their cases, interesting facts they've discovered in law books. "At times it sounds like a law firm in there," DeGrave says. "And the sentences other defendants have received. They know they're celebrities among a certain set of folks on the outside. Most have crowdfunding accounts set up to help them buy stuff from the commissary or to pay legal bills." DeGrave, whose Patriots Pod nickname is Nate Dog, and whose Facebook bio identified him as a life and success hacker, has amassed more than $111,537 in his account. "We have, like, fans," said Fellows. "People all around the country send us mail, and they've even been sending in food donations." Sixers who want iPad time and have funds to spend get to use tablets and read the news. Everyone is allowed to watch TV, and they follow the Virginia governor's race like college football fans. But they don't tune the thing to only to conservative outlets. The local D.C. news is a go-to, plus Storage Wars, Hardcore Pawn, and whenever possible, The Bachelor, The Bachelorette, or The Bachelor in Paradise. says DeGrave, all the bachelors. Grooming is problematic. No vax, no entry at the barbershop. One option is to go for the cue ball look. Fellows and DeGrave say the Sixers have recently been given hair removal cream, either Nair or Magic Cream Shave, a product that's supposed to provide depilation without razor bumps. You have to lather it on and then wait about like 5 minutes, Fellows said, and then you have to rip it out. So that's pretty painful and leaves like a sunburn-like burn on your face and or head for like a day or two. One attorney told me that the Sixers get access to fingernail clippers every few weeks. Some use them to cut their hair. Ordinarily, a chunk of the Sixers' time off the block might be spent in the prison church. But the jail won't let unvaxxed prisoners congregate in the chapel. So the men have organized religion on their own, worshiping with good books mailed in by a donor. They've also concocted an internal justice system. It's biblically based, says Fellows, and encourages people to hash out issues between themselves first, with escalating interventions by ever larger groups of negotiators if talks break down. We don't fight it out or anything, he explains. We'll go in a room and we'll talk it out. And sometimes we'll vote on the issue. To hear the Sixers tell it, the gang has ups and downs with the predominantly black guards. There was one, Fellow said, who provoked an argument with him when she said she wished she were the leader of the BLM, a desire he likens to a white guard walking into an all-black cell and saying, hey, I wish I were leader of the KKK. Quite a gripe coming from someone who took part in a protest that attracted actual white supremacists. He also feels a caseworker has been trying to provoke the Sixers by wearing a Kamala Harris shirt. At the same time, though, Fellows believes there are guards who like being assigned to the MAGA crew because we actually work together as a unit. We don't stab each other over honey buns. There is one sore point between the two camps, though. They still tell us to put the masks on all the time. They're screaming, put on your masks, put on your masks. Besides that, that's pretty much the only thing we ever argue about in here, like, is the masks. The MAGAs do have other more serious complaints. You may remember Richard Bego Barnett, who was photographed with his boot on the desk of Nancy Pelosi's office and who bragged on camera that he'd stolen her mail and left her a note calling her a bitch. Barnett, who has pleaded not guilty, spent 109 days at the jail, where his lawyer alleges a guard made a sexually threatening comment, then called Richard's wife by her first name and told Richard that he was going to get on a plane to Arkansas, where he would sexually assault her as well. After Barnett filed a formal complaint, he says, he was placed in another part of the jail, whose inmates threatened him for 3 days, and then was sent to solitary confinement for weeks. Barnett's lawyer also says his client had the opposite problem from his fellow Sixers when it came to guards and masks. He said that after Barnett asked a nearby officer to wear a mask, 9 guards later threatened to mace him, lifted him off his feet, and threw him head and shoulder first onto the floor. Ryan Samsel, a Pennsylvania man with a long history of violence against women, who is accused of assaulting cops near the Peace Monument and giving one a concussion, he has pleaded not guilty, says the guard zip-tied his hands and beat him to the point where his jaw was broken and he couldn't see out of one eye. The roughing up, his lawyer said, was retaliation for griping that guards were taking too long to bring him toilet paper. After the incident, a judge had him moved to a lockup in Central Virginia. To lawyers who have long track records with the district's correctional operations, the Sixers' grievances sound like life in the city lockup. Nothing about their treatment should be surprising to anyone who has followed conditions at the D.C. jail, which are extremely troubling and, in our view, unconstitutional in a variety of respects for everyone, said Scott Michaelman, legal director of D.C.'s ACLU, which has sued the jail many times. The jail has been a black hole of despair. Inhumane conditions, lawsuits, and court-ordered supervision since it opened in the 1970s. As recently as 2019, the D.C. auditor found that the city's health department had often skipped inspections of the jail for years at a time. Inspections since have been more regular. The dysfunction is now a rather convenient data point for anti-statehood Republicans in Congress, who'd already made the jail's political prisoners a cause célèbre. And suddenly, after years of inaction, the city's liberal lawmakers are taking an interest in the facility, too. This just might be related to the inconvenient fact that the likes of far-right Congress members Louie Gohmert, Republican from Texas, and Marjorie Taylor Greene, Republican from Georgia, who made a well-publicized visit to the jail, have scored political points off the matter. It is frustrating and discouraging, Robert White, an at-large D.C. council member, told me. The fact that white prisoners finally got a spotlight on the jail's problem is not at all lost on the people inside the jail. They know how long this has been going on, and they know why it's getting attention now. This was adapted from an article that originally appeared in Washingtonian magazine. Here's a couple of short health and science pieces. Fourth shot won't beat Omicron. Getting a fourth COVID vaccine will boost your protective antibodies, but not enough to stop a breakthrough Omicron infection, an Israeli hospital study suggests. Just over 150 healthcare workers at the Sheba Medical Center received a fourth dose of the Pfizer vaccine. Blood tests showed that the shots triggered an increase in two key types of antibodies, but over the following 2 weeks, the number of participants who caught COVID was only slightly lower than a control group that did not receive a fourth shot. The findings will add to the debate over what proportion of the population, if any, should receive a second booster. The decision to allow the fourth vaccine to vulnerable population is probably correct, and it may give a little benefit. Research leader Jilly Regev-Yoche tells the Financial Times, but not enough to support the decision to give it to all of the population. Less lightning in lockdown. Commuter trains and office blocks weren't the only places to fall silent during COVID lockdowns, reports the Times from UK. So did the heavens. Researchers at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology found that in spring 2020, when much of the world was sheltering at home, global levels of lightning fell by up to 20%. This meteorological change appears to have been driven by the drop-off in pollution that resulted from sharp declines in traffic and industrial activity. Researchers think very fine particles of pollution play a key role in generating lightning, because they serve as platforms for ice crystals to form in clouds. The difference in charge between these ice crystals at the top of clouds and the larger hail-like particles at the bottom is thought to create lightning. So less pollution means less lightning. The steepest reduction in lightning strikes was recorded in heavily industrialized areas, such as northern Italy's Po Valley and the Indian city of Kolkata. And we'll turn over to the Talking Points page. We've got an article that refers back to that cover drawing. Biden, a roller coaster first year in office. President Biden ended his first year in office this week undeniably weaker than he began it, said Jonathan Lemire in Politico. Welcomed by Americans weary of 4 years of Trumpian chaos, Biden was riding high into the spring as vaccination accelerated, COVID receded, and the economy boomed. But today, his poll numbers have plummeted to the low 40s, and his party is in danger of being swept out of power on Capitol Hill. It's been a tale of two presidencies. A triumphant COVID vaccine rollout was followed by a massive new surge caused by the Delta and Omicron variants. Unemployment plunged, but was overshadowed by soaring inflation. Amid Democratic infighting, Biden's Build Back Better agenda crashed and burned. Republicans say Biden foolishly abandoned pledges of unity and moderation to chase a fantasy of becoming the next Franklin Roosevelt. Progressives are angry at Biden for not getting more done on voting rights and climate change. Instead of humbly promising a course correction to begin 2022, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial, Biden insists he's delivered enormous progress and done remarkably well. Even with the growing likelihood of a GOP landslide in this year's midterm elections, the message from Biden is full speed ahead. Actually, it's a wonder that Biden has achieved as much as he had, said Jackie Combs in the Los Angeles Times. His efforts to combat the new highly infectious COVID variants causing outbreaks around the world were undermined by Republican officials who promoted vaccine and mask resistance. No Democratic president in history has ever entered office with congressional majorities as small as Biden's. And stubborn centrists within his own party, Senators Joe Manchin of West Virginia and Kyrsten Sinema of Arizona, have foiled Biden's ambitious social spending plans, including dramatically expanding access to child care and health care. Republican obstructionism is also not Biden's fault, said Kirsten Powers in CNN.com. He overcame it to pass a $1 trillion infrastructure bill and the $1.9 trillion American Rescue Plan. That COVID relief bill put money in the hands of struggling Americans and businesses, preventing a deep recession and massive unemployment. True, Biden inherited an unbelievable landscape, said Charles Cook in National Review, but he can blame only himself for making such grandiose promises. He vowed to shut down the virus and last July 4th said, "We're closer than ever to declaring our independence from COVID." He pledged to stop the shouting and lower the temperature, but recently compared opponents of his election reforms to segregationist Bull Connor and Confederate President Jefferson Davis. Under Biden's watch, violent crime spiked, gas prices ballooned, illegal immigration at the U.S.-Mexico border hit two-decade highs, and a horribly mismanaged withdrawal from Afghanistan left 13 U.S. service members dead. Perhaps Biden's most stunning failure, said Scott Jennings in the Louisville Courier-Journal, is his complete misjudgment about why he was elected in the first place. Voters didn't sign up for a far-left transformation of the government and economy. They just wanted someone less crazy than Bernie Sanders or Donald Trump. The success of the Biden economy is the best-kept secret in Washington, said Ezra Klein in the New York Times. Unemployment has fallen to 3.9%, the largest one-year drop in U.S. history. Wages are high, new businesses are forming at record rates, and poverty has fallen below its pre-pandemic levels. But the recovery created new problems by fueling a major boom in consumer demand that worsened a pandemic-related global supply chain crisis and led to an annual inflation rate of 7%, the highest rate in decades. And while the spread of Omicron isn't the Biden administration's fault, it is to blame for the paucity of its tests, effective masks, and ventilation upgrades. By the time Omicron hit, Americans should have had easy access to hundreds of millions of cheap N95 or KN95 masks. Look at the big picture, said the Washington Post in an editorial. In 12 months, Biden has restored integrity to the office and finally pushed through needed funding for roads, bridges, and other infrastructure. He's a huge upgrade on Trump. Still, Biden could use a reset. He was wise last week to express willingness to substantially pare down the Build Back Better bill to match Manchin's preferences, with the climate and energy provisions remaining at its core. Instead of clinging to hopes of filibuster reform needed to pass Democrats' voting rights agenda, Biden should focus attention on the gravest threat to elections, a partisan subversion of vote counting. Biden's first year was not as bleak as his critics suggest, but he'll get more done if he behaves more like a pragmatic former senator he promised to be. And a short note or two. About 30% of standard bulbs sold in the U.S. outside of California in 2020 were incandescent or halogen bulbs instead of the more efficient LED bulbs. Dollar and discount stores still mostly sell the traditional bulbs, which use about 12 times more electricity and burn out much faster, while stores catering to more affluent customers sell the LED bulbs. About 1.6 million people have cases pending in U.S. immigration court and face average waits of nearly 5 years for a decision. In 2009, the backlog was about 200,000 cases and the average wait, 14.5 months. Got two short quotes for you. First from Ursula Le Guin, who says, "Morning comes whether you set the alarm or not." And columnist Judith Martin says, "If you can't be kind, at least be vague." And with that, we have run out of time for today's program, episode of the week. I hope you enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is underwritten by the law firm of W.G. Alexander and Associates. Alexander attorneys provide top-rated, experienced legal counsel concentrating on estate planning, elder law, special needs, and asset protection. Call W.G. Alexander and Associates at 919-256-7000. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please give us a call. That number is 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.